A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Jules Gillis is the earliest Untitled Banter podcast we've ever done. And I know. It's only 9:45 in the morning, but we're very half asleep. We're chugging on the caffeine. We're getting through.
I love the fact that you say that when you know for a fact I wake up at like 6:30 every morning. I am an early bird, my friend. And I've caught the worm, and that worm is the UBP,
The UBP.
Tasty grub.
It is the Untitled Banter podcast, where we take your latest questions, talking points, whatever you've got going on in your mind. Now, we got a lovely response last week, so I thought we'd roll some stuff over. However, awesome. I did also put a tweet out yesterday. What do we even call them now? Posts? X's? I don't know.
Zeets.
I put a zeet out yesterday asking people what their latest thoughts are. And there's a lot of stuff doing the rounds on Baldur's Gate 3. Okay. Obviously, that game, massive deal, being talked about a lot, is currently the highest rated game of the year, beating Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. I'm yet to play, and I'm waiting for the console version. But the conversation around that game, alongside how incredible it is this whole thing about how it changes what a AAA game is. It changes the expectations of the best games in the industry. I saw IGN's video went viral, and there's a lot of that stuff. A lot of people just messaging, just going, can we just talk about all of that stuff? Have you been keeping up with all this?
I have indeed, and I find it quite funny that the people who seem to be positing this whole sort of like, oh, it's setting unrealistic expectations for video games are usually those people who are at the forefront of, well, let's say companies that don't ever intend to put out fully polished games in the first place. And it's like, I can't believe we're in a state now where people are defending it, saying, oh, look, it's putting too much pressure on the developers. It's putting too much pressure on the publishers to release games in as polished state as Baldur's Gate 3. Not all of them have like 10 years to make this game. And it's like, no one puts those restrictions on you but the company itself. If you aren't going to make a deadline, then you're going to have to push back, because at the end of the day, people are going to support Baldur's Gate 3. They're going to keep supporting that when it goes forward. And if it ever decides to release expansions or additional content for it, then everyone's going to be like, yeah, of course I'm going to go with this, because I know that the quality, that seal of assurance is already there. If you're then going on the other side and saying, look, you're going to need a day one patch to even have this game in a playable state, and even then we can't promise anything, people are just going to be like, what's the point? You end up like me, where I just go, I'm going to wait for the game of the year edition. I'm going to wait until you fixed everything before I go and play this game. And by that point, I'm getting it at a cheaper price point, and I'm waiting for all of the bugs to be ironed out, and they're getting less of a sale from me, in essence.
Well, my thing is, like, I just think the biggest issue is industry-wide. It's a lack of optics on how games are made. Like, the amount of times when a game is 2 or 3 months from launch, and it's still like, oh, I hope they add this, I hope they put this feature in. It's like, that was locked down almost a year ago or something, in terms of, like, the baseline idea of what the mechanics are. And so Baldur's Gate 3, as much as it's being held up as, like, this new sort of AAA benchmark thing, like you said, it's been in development for close to, I think it's like 8 or 10 years. It was sort of kickstarted or whatever, crowdfunded into existence. There's an earlier version that was reviewed by IGN. It got 7 out of 10. Like, it's one of those things where over time it was, you know, Larian's co-founder, I forget what the name of that dude is, but he put a lot of his personal money, fortune, whatever, into it, which is what allowed it to keep going and keep getting refined and get to this point. It is not at all a model of AAA gaming. It's not even, it's very much its own thing.
And I guess basically like an indie game that became a AAA game. Like, I know that it's attached to a franchise that has like a significant legacy, so it does have a AAA founding, but it's the case of, like you say, it was brought into existence by crowdfunding, by personal ambition, and also a lot of personal sacrifice as well. And AAA games don't do that. Like, you look back at like the a recent example of Final Fantasy 16. That game sold however many million units.
It was like 3 million or something in the first couple of weeks.
It is the fastest selling, best selling Final Fantasy game ever. And yet they still see it as a categorical failure within the board meetings, because it didn't hit their so-called lofty expectations.
It's because it didn't maintain that thing as well, like the opening sales. It didn't keep going on that trajectory. Apparently it spiked and then it like plateaued or something.
But it's so bizarre that people think that they're going to have like a GTA Online with every single game that they put out just by putting money into it. And it's like, no, that doesn't immediately mean that you're going to get a return on investment that is exponential and keeps growing. And it's a very strange thing to see people comparing these games when in actuality, they shouldn't be going, oh dear, it's causing a problem for us. They should be going, round of applause, thank you, and also we're going to try and do better and emulate what you've done here.
Well, that's kind of the thing is I mean, obviously, like, there was the IGN video that did the rounds a lot. It's mostly the sentiment of that video that did the rounds more than the reality of what the actual situation is. Like, there are a lot of devs obviously giving Baldur's Gate its flowers and saying, like, this is an incredible feat of game design. Same as Tears of the Kingdom. It's very, like, you know, the actual matrix of the different points of that game's design that talk to each other is incredibly complex, and that should be celebrated. But there was a similar sentiment when Tears of the Kingdom came out. There was like a little video showing like a bit where Link sort of makes a bridge between two items, and then it makes tension and it makes a whole bridge, and it's like, that is like such a feat of coding to like make this physics item out of nothing, and that was like a thing at the time of like devs going like, oh my god, what the hell are we going to do next? But I kind of just equate that to like when I was learning guitar, or if anyone's learning an instrument or anything, and you see a master of their craft, like, you know, they're way further down the line than you. Like you said, to some degree it should only really be inspirational. I don't think there's a genuine knockback from the mainstream. I don't think people are going, every game needs to be this. I think the average person can understand that it's either Nintendo, it's Baldur's Gate, it's a one-off. Like, I think that it's tied in with the optics of the industry overall, and more making of documentaries will be a hell of a lot better. But I think the sentiment has done the rounds more that devs are annoyed about it, or devs or whatever. I just don't think they are. I think it's more of a, it's just noticing what it is.
It's like fan projection. It's because we are annoyed when we have day one games that are barely playable. And so we then go like, well, the devs are going to be like, you know, really taken aback by this because they've been shown. And that's probably like, at the end of the day, we're making a game to the limits that we're prescribed by our either publisher or company that's above us. Like, if they're told you have to turn this around within a year, like an annualized sequel, there's not much they can do. And we all saw what happens if that model carries on without sustaining properly. And that's what happened with the WWE franchise with the 2K stuff. They had to take significant time off to rework everything from the ground up and start again. But the problem is they haven't actually fixed the core root there. We're going to get that game again and again and again every year, but it's now just that version of it that's going to crumble into dust, and then we're going to have another backlash and start again. There's no evolution going on here. It's just repairing.
And that's the thing, is like one of the core sort of like sentiments that comes out of this is the idea of like, look at Baldur's Gate 3 as it is right now. It is this extremely polished, extremely impressive game. And like I said before, but that only came from years of refinement with the ability to do that refining over time. It's not that you can hold this up as a way of saying all games need to be this polished or this complete or whatever. It's a wider problem. Like, Baldur's Gate is not the you know, the example that proves the rule kind of thing. It's not the thing that everyone can do. It's just not.
But the reality is, like you say, it should be aspirational. Every developer should look at that and say, I want my game to be as polished, well-respected, and well-received as this game. How can I make that happen? But behind-the-scenes limitations that, as you said before, are covered up because there isn't as much transparency within the video game industry as we would like, mean that we don't get to see that. What we get to see from, let's just say, an average video game fan is, developer puts out a bad game. That's all they see.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is like, that's the thing. That's the overall thing that we can all agree on, is that we want games that work at launch. We don't want a Redfall or whatever other broken games end up coming
out. I was just about to bring that up. Like, I mean, Redfall's a great example. The same with the Lord of the Rings Gollum game. It's a case of, I don't think that any developer sat down, cracked their knuckles, leant back in their chair and said, right, let's make an absolutely cack game. Let's just do it, lads. Like, open up the skip and let's go fishing. No one sets out to do that. It's just a case of, they go there and they go, okay, we don't have the budget to do this, we don't have the budget to do that, okay, we're gonna have to make concessions here, okay, there's a time frame delay, okay, there's an issue with this, that means that we can't do this, okay, we've just bought in a new engine because our bosses want to start using this as the proprietary tech and it doesn't work with this, and by that time you've stitched everything together, it is in nowhere near what it's meant to be. I mean, your friend Tommy Miller, yeah, it was a case of, whenever you speak to him about sort of the video game developing side of it, it's just like, these games are barely stitched together to work this one way, and it's
it's a miracle if anything comes up.
Yeah, and it's like, and it's through trial and error to get that thing even working with the massive resources. Like, they can only do the best that they can do.
Totally. Also, clarity on Tommy Miller. He was an ex-Ubisoft employee who works various indie studios. He did a few articles for us on the site. I don't actually know the dude.
Oh, sorry. I thought that was a pre-established thing there.
No, like in touch in terms of a freelancer getting in touch with the company thing. But yeah, he's done a few articles for the website. We adapted some of them to videos, lots of insider knowledge and stuff for what it's like working in the industry. But yeah, that's one of those things where if anything, you could hold up Baldur's Gate and go, look how well received this polished game is. And you would hope that that works in the various meetings that happen across the board when it comes to coders, art departments, everything else, being able to stand up for their teams saying we need more time. Like you said at the beginning, it is more about hopefully being able to push back against those deadlines and ultimately result in a more polished product. And I think that's the response is, oh my God, look at the size of this thing and it's not falling apart at the seams. That's the ultimate thing.
Maybe we should create the distinction that the, like you say, the sentiment of that IGN video of the developers must be annoyed, but that maybe that is not true. What the actual statement should be is publishers are annoyed by that,
right?
Because it's setting what they consider to be unrealistic expectations of fans who won't pre-order and be ready to download a day one patch that's bigger than the game itself. They are the ones that are getting annoyed because they're like, oh, okay, they're actually starting to ask for more. They're finally going to ask. Whereas the developers are like, yes, that's what we want to deliver. Please push back enough so that it reaches the publisher to give us more time, space, and creative freedom.
Yeah, entirely. I think like there's a whole thing about like the average dev time or the idea of how much dev time something needs has been, you know, it's needed to be elongated for quite a long time. Like all the stuff that's happening at the minute with Modern Warfare 3, where that game, like it's, you know, it's going to be this year's Call of Duty, but all the maps are remasters from like the old one. And it's things like that where it's like corners are starting to be cut to try and hit faster turnarounds, in this case to hit annual models, and it's very obvious. I think that the Baldur's Gate 3 thing is a massive conversation and it'll only be more explored when the console versions hit because way more people are going to play it. But yeah, it is an interesting talking point just because of the reality of how it came together, but hopefully the best lessons can be learned from it. It is still an incredible feat. Like I do just look at all the footage and be like, I can't wait to poke and prod at that thing myself. Like I just want to play it.
Well, it was there was a tiny video that popped up onto my feed the other day about how this person was playing a rogue class and had met somebody who was trying to scam them out of a magical item or like trying to get some coin out of them. And there was a dialogue tree that went on for a good sort of 5 minutes back and forth with all these crazy things that you could only access if you were speaking to that one specific character and chose that one specific path that you would only get from playing as a rogue. And it's like the fact that it was all voice acted, motion captured, had all of these like intriguing facets where there was multiple choices even within that dialogue tree. It was like, that's so impressive. And so I would say, I'm using the word unnecessary, but I don't mean it in the sense of like superfluous. I just feel like it's the
unwarranted
amount of effort and love that went into just doing that aspect is why that game is going to be so well received and probably
I think
well
it's why it's like, you know, it's reminding people of like old BioWare and like old, obviously top down CRPGs and things like that. Like things where the dev accounted for every last thing you might think of.
Yes.
Like I saw, there was a clip the day of like someone who just picked an item out of their inventory and threw it and their companion dog ran and got it, played fetch with it and brought it back to the player. And I was like, I love that they thought of that. That's awesome. And there's loads of little things like that, that they're just sort of like, whatever you do, they've already thought of it.
Because they wouldn't have criticized the game for taking the item out, throwing it and nothing happened. Like if nothing had happened, no one would have batted an eye. But the fact that something did happen, it's reactive. And that's, I think, the magic of video games is that it's about exploring the video game world in an intangible way with tangible action. So it's like, like you say, I'm not doing anything. Nothing would happen if I did that normally. But the fact that it comes back, it's rewarding me for doing something that is completely pointless.
It's like it encourages like a level of thinking that I talk about loads on podcasts and videos and whatever, but it's pure gameplay and it's pure gaming as a medium. It's not rooted in narrative or film or TV or passive stuff. It's fundamentally interaction based. Like you can only do that in gaming. Yeah. And like another one is apparently if you don't drink potions, if you throw them instead, they splash and heal in a radius.
That's
I love that. And it's like little things like that you might just stumble upon or whatever. And I know that that's just scratching the surface of the millions of different things you can do.
It reminds me.
I love that it's all in there.
So much of like how Disco Elysium hit the market. It was just a case of like, it's the you can do this question mark that's the selling point of these types of games. Just like really rewarding the player's imagination and willingness to explore.
Rewarding imagination, that's a really good way to put it. Like rewarding imagination and rewarding experimentation is something the industry used to do a lot more of. And now it's a lot more scripted stuff in certain spaces, like at certain levels of budgets and everything, which again is why this stands out because there's so much money in it, but it's still super experimental.
Going back to Breath of the Wild, Tears of the Kingdom, like the experimentation of just fusing items and weapons together and also manipulating the gravity and sort of physics engine from the first game, it's like it breaks the game, but at no point did anyone complain about that. Everyone was just like, this is so much fun. And Nintendo were like, yeah, we knew you could do this, we're not going to stop you, so whatever, just have fun.
That's another thing as well, is that in that case, obviously Breath of the Wild was 2017, they apparently immediately started on the sequel, and then it was one of those things where they prototyped that idea of what became the now the physics engine thing, or the manipulation that's in the new one, but that took them like 5-6 years to get that thing right. And it's
you can tell,
but like only certain companies are able to do that, whether it's a private you know, someone with a lot of money like the head of Larian, or it's someone like Nintendo where they just have such a fortune to put into it. Red Dead Redemption 2 was another one. The amount of polish in that game, literally only it's a miracle. Like it's a one-off. You're not going to get another Red Dead Redemption 2. There'll be very few and far between. We should get to some questions because it is the entire about the podcast. So we'll get through as many questions as we can. First one from the 228th Gunner of 2023.
Love it.
You're presented with a button. If you press it, there will never be another game sequel or remake ever again, and instead releases will only be one time new IP. Do you push the button?
Oh, that's a tough one, because sometimes you can end up with sequels fixing the problems of the first game and become the reason to stick with that franchise. Like, I don't get me wrong, I absolutely love Dead Space, but Dead Space 2 is the absolute pinnacle of that. Dead Rising 2, same sort of thing. It's like that that
Mass
idea.
Effective.
Yeah, exactly. It's the idea of like you are building on solid foundations to provide a greater game overall. If I just got Mass Effect 1 and not Mass Effect the trilogy, I probably would have been quite disappointed, because while I enjoyed Mass Effect 1, I think it was a very fine game, but the combat sucks in that game, let's be honest, man. And the whole sort of like Mako...
You don't like frisbeeing grenades from behind cover?
It's the Mako driving sections as
well. Oh, they're the best bit!
Nah, man, nah. When you say it's the best, what do you really mean? Is it though?
I think it's really, it doesn't make any sense. Like logistically, they're all dying inside that ship, but it's like, really bouncy.
It's got like some sort of anti-grav thing to keep them suspended in
like
there.
Like in a bubble in the middle.
It's awful, man. Like oh, just.
I love the Mako. Mako Defense Force. The Mako did nothing wrong. I love the Mako.
Fair enough, man. I mean, but it's a case of, I think that sometimes it takes a sequel to deliver on a great idea. If we pushed the button, for example, and we got the single IPs, we wouldn't ever get the remake of or the reimagining of God of War, for example, because that would count as a sequel to the greater.
You wouldn't even have
franchise.
God of War 2 or anything. You'd only get the original.
Exactly. And sometimes there are these games that come out and they are perfect. They hit that note and then they go off into the sunset. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it's the wider franchise. We wouldn't have got any Red Dead Redemptions. We would have got Red Dead Revolver, and that would have been it. And don't get me wrong, I love that game. I'm just saying that, like, it's so different from what
the thing is. In the way that this question's phrased, this is to get super hyper granular about it. The way this question's phrased is, you push the button, there'll never be another sequel or remake ever again. And also, he says, only be one time new IP. So from now on, would you push the button now? And then it's like, going forward.
So we get to keep all of the stuff.
Bank everything we've got so far.
I mean, that wouldn't be terrible, actually, considering the state that the gaming industry is in nowadays.
That's kind of my thoughts. I'm like, if I did it now, then I guarantee new IPs every time. And things can be iterative. We're only talking about IPs. We're only talking about branding. That could still be something that is very similar.
However, what we may see is that if there's only new IPs and no serials or sequels can be made, you might get everything feeling completely homogenized, because somebody will say, okay, that worked, and we are so desperate to have a success with our one chance game that we're not going to push the envelope at all. We're just going to end up with the exact same type of game again and again and again and again.
True, although I guess I would argue we kind of have that now anyway. That's kind of what the we're stuck in the middle of. I think I would push the button because I'd love to see a world of new IPs every time, and then I guess that would put the impetus on gameplay identity as alongside each individual branding exercise. But only if I can push the button now. If I'm wiping out gaming history, then no, because I'd lose Halo 2 and I'd lose all my other favorite sequels and everything. And I wouldn't even have the rest of Legacy of Kain. I'd only have the original Legacy of Kain Blood Omen. It wouldn't have anything else.
Okay, let's think about what remakes, remasters, and sequels that are coming out soon that may make you want to change your mind. So you wouldn't get Grand Theft Auto 6. Are you happy with that?
I right now can live without GTA 6. I feel like it's been way too long.
You wouldn't get any new Halos. Halo Infinite would be the last ever Halo.
They've just overhauled that to the point where
I knew you were going to say this.
I might be all right. I might be fine just going like new IPs, all new gameplay ideas. Let's go.
I'm trying to think. You'll never get a new Shovel Knight.
Oh, well, their new one's not Shovel Knight anyway. They're
getting around it. It's part of the wider franchise.
Dig Knight? No. There's their new IP. It's called like Min the Diver or something, or Mini the Diver. It's like a new.
Oh, I don't know about that.
They're doing a whole new thing.
Technically, they're actually going off on one then and doing a new IP. Okay.
I'm just thinking that, like, yeah, I think at the minute that we're definitely starved for new IP.
No more Metal Gear Solid games. I know that was obviously kind of up in the air anyway.
I guess no more Death Stranding. Yeah, well, that might be the reason that you end up pushing the button.
I'm pushing the button, mate. I don't want any more.
I would take more Death Stranding. But I think there are pros and cons to both sides. But I would definitely push the button for the lols, only if I can push it in the now.
Push the button too.
Yeah. We'll see what comes out of it. Question from Brad, who says, if you were stuck on a desert island, you could only take with you a group of games whose Metacritic score added up to less than 300. What are you taking? Essentially, quantity or quality. Oh. So I guess you could have less 90 scoring games or whatever, or more 60s, 70s, 50s, 40s.
I mean, to be fair, though, you and I are in a great situation here because we're always championing the 6 out of 10 or 7 out of 10 games. So we're under the radar, and we're getting a few easy, like, cheeky ones in there, too.
I would totally take all the 50s and 60s games. Like, I'm fine with a whole bunch of 5s and 6 out of 10. I'll take mechanical variation over polished single thing.
Me too, actually. I think that if I only had, say, 3 100-ranked games, I would get so bored of them so quickly.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
I mean, we're assuming that this desert island has got power and consoles to play it on and a nice TV. So, in fact, what we've got is a hotel on an island, and I'm not complaining about this.
It's just a little square.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, little TV set in it.
a little bit of furniture in it.
The TV's made of, like, the bamboo things.
And it's the like coconut radio.
Yeah, it's like a very polished turtle shell or something like that you're seeing the projector on. Like, so I'd say, the 6 out of 10 games, like, give me... I'm trying to think of like some notoriously average well, games.
The other day, because right now, actually, as we're talking, the
Pandemonium, for example, for the PlayStation okay. 1, like that's like a 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10 game, right?
Bishy Bashy Special. I mean, I don't know if I'm alone on this island, but I'd play that. Yeah. I think right now, as we're talking, there's a whole thing doing the rounds that Xbox have announced the Xbox 360, the ability to purchase Xbox 360 games is going away mid-2024.
Oh, so
there's a list of all the games that are going to be going away forever. They've also said other stuff's going to be on backwards compatibility, whatever.
Do you still get to keep them and play them if they've downloaded to your...
As far as I know, yeah. I need to look into it more. I need to the email just before we started recording.
That would be rubbish if they were just like, nah, sorry, you bought it and then you only have until this, like that Super Mario's game or whatever it was. Remember the one?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think it's like the way that Switch tried to do it. Well, Switch is doing on the 3D, Nintendo, sorry, doing on the 3DS and PlayStation / Sony did it on the Vita. So I think as long as you own the file, you can always get it from the server somehow.
Okay.
They're just not processing the transactions anymore. I need to look into it more, but either way, just thinking of old Xbox stuff that I love, like Dead to Rights is such a 6/7 out of 10 game that I could just play over and over again. That's just what made me think of that, but yeah, the 360 thing's doing
the wrong. Just saying that just made me think of the Red Dead Revolver / Redemption adjacent Gun. Do you remember that?
Yeah, go, my God. Gun versus Red Dead.
Gun was a 7/6. Gun was a solid 7 out of 10 game.
Very true. Yeah, at the time it was like PsyOps versus Second Sight and Gun versus Red Dead.
Yeah,
they had clear winners, I would say, PsyOps and Red Dead, but it's a different thing. question from Juan Castaneda, who says, do you think it will take another video game crash or a big company / publisher closing to change the video game industry? Because it seems like we never learn our lesson. P.S. I think Starfield is going to severely underwhelm, if not suck. Castaneda also said, what was the biggest argument you had with childhood friends about video games? And all of these are great points.
Oh man, that's good. I mean, the biggest childhood argument was just the console war back and forth between my friends. Like at middle school, or the American version of high school, it'd be a case of talking to people about what games they were playing at the weekend. And I had a original Xbox first and then got on the PS2 bandwagon quite late. And so all my friends were like, oh, you can't play this. You can't play the Final Fantasy VII games. You can't play all of this. You can't play that. And I was like, yeah, that does actually kind of suck. But at the same time, I do have Halo. And everyone was like, yeah, but that's all you've got. That's all Halo, all you've got. And I was like, but at the end of the day, do you want to come around and play Halo at mine on the weekend? Yeah, of course we do. Of course we do.
I was trying to think of like the biggest ones. By far, the console wars, like you said. I feel like that had different generations. It was either PS2 versus Xbox or 360 versus PS3. Game specific stuff. For whatever reason, my year, and I talked about this on a podcast a while ago, my year erupted over Final Fantasy X versus Metal Gear Solid 2. It was just, at the time, it was like you picked a side. You were either on board with RPGs and turn-based stuff, or you were on the sort of military Western side, and you were like, oh, turn-based combat. Oh, I want to shoot dudes. Oh. And I love both of them. I was never going to pick a side. If I had to, it's probably Metal Gear, but I love them both. But that was the big one for us. It was like the whole Yeah group trying to pick one side or the other. Do you have any favorites? What would you pick? If you had to pick Metal Gear 2 or Final Fantasy X?
Oh, that's a tough one because...
I know.
I had Final Fantasy X first, and then I got Metal Gear Solid 2 off my friend Liam later.
Ten story gets so bad later as well.
It does, but I had a very good time overall it was kind of like, once you got past into the third act, it was kind of switch your brain off and just have fun with the battle system, and that was always quite nice, and the sphere grid was always a very cool
It still does well. Have the best battle system.
Yeah,
like, Octopath Traveler has it now, but yeah.
It's the best version of the ATB system, whatever it was called.
Knocking people out of the timeline and everything, if I'm remembering right.
I really like that.
Yeah.
I think that overall, I probably had a much more fun gameplay experience with Metal Gear Solid 2 because Liam and I went through and tried to play through on European Extreme, and that was so hard. We were stuck on the Fortune elevator fight for probably two solid days. We were just like, I stayed over at his house and we were playing it again and again and again because it's a one-hit kill scenario and there are falling elements, like, you know, when the lights start falling and stuff like that. In the regular gameplay, they do nothing, but in European Extreme, if one of the lights hits you, you die. And I'm like,
she can shoot you through crates as well.
Yeah, it sucked, man. But it was, I had a very good time with that.
Are you coming down on
By the way, I'm just remembering another argument I had with my friendship group about Kingdom Hearts.
I
was over at a friend's house and I brought Kingdom Hearts over because they weren't too sure about what the mix was. And they just were like, it's got Disney in. This is so stupid. What are you on about? This is such an idiotic idea. How can this be cool? And I'd played the game loads up until that point. So I showed them the the opening cinematic, and they were all in agreement, like, okay, that's actually a pretty cool cinematic with, like, Riku, whatever the main...
Sora's the main dude, but Riku's
the head guy that is in
your... Oh, God, no.
He's, like, your antagonist friend guy. He, like, goes into the water, and everyone's like, oh, that's actually really, really cool. And then I was like, ah, but wait until you see this. So I loaded up the battle arena, the Colosseum, and I loaded up the Sephiroth fight, because that's where I'd got to. And I was like, Sephiroth is in this game. And they were all like, oh my God, this is amazing. That sounds so cool. Loaded it up. He comes in with his great art style. And obviously, this is the first time in any game where he's actually looked more than 3 pixels.
Yeah,
so I was like, whoa, this is amazing. And then the battle started. And they were like, this is garbage, Jules. This is utter, this is rubbish. And I was like, what, why? And he's like, why are you floating around the ring? Like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I don't know. He's like,
but it looks
like,
good.
He's like, you look so goofy. Like, and it's like, you've got these like stupid powers and they're doing no damage to him. And I was like, yeah, but, and they're like, this game is rubbish, Jules. You are stupid for liking this game. I was like, oh, right. Oh,
you're actually not welcome in the house anymore, Jules. Like, this has gone too far.
Okay, this has gone, this has taken a hard left
turn. I remember the Christmas when I got Kingdom Hearts, because it was like, that. Yeah, that's a good point, because everyone at the time was like, you're either with Final Fantasy or with Kingdom Hearts. It was like, oh my God. It was like the Wind Waker split for Zelda. It was like, oh my God, this is for kids. And like, you couldn't possibly appreciate the art style. You just had to pick a side. Yeah, Kingdom Hearts, when I played it that Christmas, I remember thinking the same thing about the combat, where I was like, I just can't get used to this. I want full turn-based or live action or whatever. And I just couldn't get Kingdom Hearts to click at all. Where are you at on Starfield? Do you think it's going to underwhelm, if not outright suck?
I don't want it to. I really want them to have a success, because I feel like this is... the most hyped I've been for a Bethesda game in a long, long time. However, I've been so badly burnt by the likes of Fallout 76. So I was a bit like, what do I think this is going to be? I feel like I can't ever take Todd Howard's promises seriously, so I've got to always take them with like a truckload of salt and be like, look, if he says that there's going to be 1,000 explorable planets, there's probably going to be 1,000 very small planets.
I think they said, it's like a fraction.
Like explorable planets or something like that. They're probably going to be like small dungeon style things. I fully expect there to be issues with the frame rate, graphics, gameplay. There will be issues galore, because it's so funny to start this podcast talking about Baldur's Gate and how it is a shining exemplar of polished gameplay, and then talk about Starfield when you just know in your very bones it will not be as good as they
promise. What if they pull it off though? What if we boot it up?
But I'm glad to be wrong. I want to be wrong. Do you like this is the best part of being a cynic, my friend, is that you can always stand there and be like, prove me wrong. Oh, you did. Well, humble pie on my face, but joke's on you, because I got a good game.
Yeah, that's the thing. I want to be able to put, because the thing is, like I mentioned Halo Infinite before, that game has had this not insane complete overhaul, but the physics are a bit different. Sliding's faster, movement's faster. They've added tons of stuff to unlock and ranking up systems and everything else. It finally feels like what it should have been at launch. Yeah. And it always played well, but it plays way better now. And it's one of those things where it's like, you just, when you put it on, it's immediate. It's like, oh, okay, this feels like what you could buy a console for, and it feels immediately responsive and rewarding, and it's just satisfying. I hope that's the case for Starfield. I hope it just goes. You don't have some weird facial animation bug or some weird loading issue or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Physics issue, because Bethesda always have physics stuff where characters fly around the map and whatever else. I just hope it gets there, because it's on the same day as Baldur's Gate 3 for consoles.
Yes.
But Baldur's is only on PlayStation, so it's kind of going to be a PS5 versus Xbox thing anyway. But yeah, I don't think it's going to underwhelm or suck. I just think it's maybe not going to be a 10 out of 10 polished thing. I still think it's going to be a Bethesda game.
So you're never ever expecting it to be a 10 out of 10. So therefore you're not going to be coming in under your underestimations. You'll just be like,
I think there's like an expectation that it's going to be like a Sony first party. Like it's going to be like a Last of Us style game, but massively open world and everything else. And I just don't think Bethesda can hit that, nor are they trying to. I think they're just trying to make these big, you know, experimental physics-y sandbox things with lots of items. So I guess we'll see. Castaneda also said about, do you think that the industry needs a crash for everyone to learn their lesson? This year is like the year for gaming. It's when everything came back, but it is all sequels and stuff. There are still certain things that are just crashing day one, like, you know, bombing, like the likes of Suicide Squad is never going to be able to recover. I do think there's an issue with, you know, the pitfalls of the industry. Like if you get a foot wrong, there's so much to be gained, but you can also lose everything immediately. There's no real safety net, but at the same time, it's kind of their fault for doing such a obvious forced safe bet approach anyway, like the MCU movies or the DC movies that keep failing as well.
Exactly, yeah. I think that they're learning their lessons like immediately. Like when these games come out and they just aren't polished or have been well thought out enough or are actually respecting the audience's time or patience or the fact that we just don't want to spend so much in these video games anymore for very little. I think that them failing out of the gate is basically, that's the warning sign to everyone else. So we don't necessarily need a video game crash, because I feel like that would rob everyone of like potentially great indie games and stuff that's AAA or AA sort of thing. And I feel like the ones that are failing hard are being held up as examples of what not to do. The industry evolves slowly, but it is evolving a little bit each time that these failures happen.
Yeah.
I mean, what really needs to happen is for the EA sports franchises like FIFA or whatever they're calling it nowadays, EA's football club. EA Sunday League needs to like, that needs to have like a massive stumbling as well for them to learn lessons to improve on the formula. As I said before with the WWE 2K stuff, the only way we got innovation in that game is by failing spectacularly.
They happen on a per game basis. WWE 2K had one, Assassin's Creed had one. Like they tend to not be industry wide. The industry is almost too big to fail at this point. Yeah. I know it's almost the cursed phrase, but it seems to be per franchise at this point.
Yeah, and I think that that's the only way that they learn is that they have to have one absolute colossal failure. I mean, there's a good chance that going the way that things are going, if God of War obviously has had like an impeccable reimagining and had a fantastic sequel, it actually is in that third phase now where it will either be a trilogy capper to end all trilogy cappers and will probably cement itself as being one of the best gaming trilogies ever.
Yes.
Or this will be their trying point more so than the second game where things were obviously set in motion in the first to go into the second, where the third game is going to be like, where do we go and how do we improve this? And this will be their true litmus test, effectively.
I think for in terms of like if there's any crash relating to Sony, it'll be the live service stuff. I think they're going to pump too many of them out way too fast.
Yeah.
You know, Horizon, Last of Us, Fair Games, Foam Stars. Like, there's way too many in the pipeline. Yeah, just none of them have demoed well. I mean, Foam Stars apparently play as well, but the reception's not been very strong.
Yeah.
I can't see that doing very well. Final question from Morten Nielsen, who says, just bought Elden Ring, which is my first Soulsborne game. Should I dive into it without reading any guides or not? Seems to me like a lot of people use guides for character builds and which order to do quests. I don't think you should use a guide at all.
No, not at all. Not at all. Elden Ring's one of those games where, unfortunately, even if you, unless you play with a guide in hand and follow exactly to the letter what that person is telling you, then you're going to miss out some side quests here and there, and you're going to have some quest lines closed off. But that is the joy of Elden Ring or Soulsborne-like games, because it's about exploring, about finding what character path you've done. So sometimes you'll be like, stumble across a secret, and that feeling is so much better than just going, okay, well, the game guide told me to stand here under this tree and ring this bell three times or something like that. And it's like, you have no context as to why that's important, but doing it just gives you a reward or a boss battle. And that isn't as fun, I think, because it's the context of learning what about that world makes sense to your character.
I would never follow a guide first time through either.
Like that's taking the sort of fun out of it. But it's weird because we go back to the Final Fantasy stuff that we were talking about before. I know that on day one, there were people who there used to be in my hometown of Newton Abbott. Yeah.
Yeah.
there was a game store that was right in the central thoroughfare. And people would be buying their games day one, and there'd always be like a guidebook section alongside it. And I remember when Final Fantasy, I want to say 12 came out, I remember this guy in the queue in front of me that had the copy of the game and the official guide. And I was like, so what he's going to do is he's going to read the guide and just play the game exactly as the developers tell you to play it, or he's going to just use it to find all the secrets and never have any challenge in that game whatsoever. And I was like, that doesn't seem that fun.
Because they used to sell you them. They used to like sell you. Oh, do you want the guide as well? And it was like, no. Yeah, like, why would I? Because I mean, maybe some people like it, and it's almost like an instruction manual for like a 5,000 piece Lego set. Where it's, well, I guess I'll just do it this way or something. Yeah. But I think I always think just go through the game yourself, especially in Elden Ring's case. You can't really go wrong. If you hit a roadblock difficulty wise, pick a different direction. You'll find something cool. You know, you'll level up that way. You'll come back. It'll all make sense.
If anything, what was really funny was when I started out, obviously, like many people, not to do any spoilers for people who have still yet to play this game, you are obviously told that there's with your bonfires, you've got the Spirit of Grace, is that what it's called, where it shows you where to go roughly?
Yeah, I think so.
Like it's like a little like golden arc that just says over that way there's something important. And I always just was like, okay, cool, I'll go towards that for the first couple of times and see where we're at. I came up against a few bosses that were a bit more challenging than I would have liked to admit. And then I was like, okay, well, let's explore the area. I carried on going north up through that map for absolutely ages and ages until I was suddenly like, I wonder what was behind the starting area. And so when I went back to the starting area, I found like the whole expanse down there. And I was genuinely amazed at, like,
yes,
there's so much of this game world that I would have just missed if I hadn't had that thought of, but what's over there? Like,
what's over there is the crux of why Elden Ring is one of the greatest games of all time. Like, you cannot go wrong picking any direction. You'll always find something cool. Every part of that game talks to every other part of it. In terms of, like, the enemy leveling and everything else, like, it's great.
You know when you go into the big flooded marshland area where it's like the big college of illusions and stuff is there? Mm-hmm. There's a massive like cave network to the left, and like it's like a big open mouth cave. And I remember walking through there underneath like the normal green roots pass along the top, and I was like looking around there, I was battling some enemies, I was like farming some items, and I just happened to move the camera and look up and saw that there was a structure within the cave system up in the back corner, and I was like, wait, how do I get up there? So I was like following it around for ages, and eventually found like a tiny doorway that led me all the way up to the top of this thing, and I was like, wow, that was amazing. And then there was like a secret boss site up there, there was a secret quest line up there, and there was another character you could like recruit to help you out, and I was like, all because I was just like, oh, there's some game. The game has informed me that something's up there because I should have paid attention to the room that I was in more. And I was like, it just rewards you for looking.
Yeah, to bring it like full circle, that is part of why Baldur's Gate's a big deal, and hopefully why Starfield will be a big deal. Yeah. It was Todd Howard who did that, like the memeable phrase of like, "See that mountain? You can go there."
Yeah, you can go.
And
there.
It's like if they start actually rewarding that stuff again, then that does end up making the best open world games. For now, though, this has been the Untitled Banter podcast, the UBP. I've been Scott Taylor. That's been Jules Gill.
I have indeed. Thank you very much for having me. Now, I just got to say, I won't be here next week because I'll be.
Oh no.
Gamescom, baby.
You will.
So I'll be sending my love to the UBP fans.
Yeah, go find, track down Jules Gill, take some photos, tell him he's a nice, lovely man, and we'll have him back on as soon as he's available. For now, though, thank you all very, very much for sending in your questions and listening, and we'll catch you very soon. Goodbye.
Bye, everyone.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.